this progress, of course, has come from sort of making use of the integrability in the planar limit. So we're always interested in the planar limit and where is underlying integrability. And in particular, at weak coupling, so when the coupling in the planar limit, the Etoff coupling, is much less than, much less than one, or it's small, there's a sort of an effective description of the calculation of such anomalous dimensions. It can be mapped to a spin chain problem. So there's some spin chain Hamiltonian, there's some states, and the problem of calculating anomalous dimensions gets mapped into calculating the spectrum of the spin chain. So sort of at weak coupling, sort of the spin chain description is very useful. Of course, we know by sort of the ADS-CFT duality that the problem of calculating anomalous dimensions gets mapped to calculating string energies. So in particular, when lambda is much, much larger than one, we have sort of classical strings. on ADS5 times S5. And then sort of for intermediate, so this is sort of string theory or classical string theory. And sort of in the intermediate region, so when lambda is some finite value, there's some integrable model. I'm just going to call it quantum strings, exactly what you want to think of it as. Sort of it's up to yourself. That's some sort of integrable model. And so, you know, this problem, as I say, has sort of seen a good deal of progress. And one of the sort of key steps in understanding this thing is to understand the whirl sheet theory for such quantum strings. And so the sort of the string whirl sheet theory, as I say, is a 1 plus 1 dimensional massive integrable model. And for such a model, sort of as is sort of well known in sort of integrable theories, the spectrum of energies of quantum strings or the quantum model is in large part determined by the scattering matrix. So we can define a string whirl sheet scattering matrix or whirl sheet scattering matrix. We just need the 2 to 2, so I have some particles, they carry some quantum numbers, some flavors. This is going to correspond to the indices J1, J2, or I1 and I2. They also have some momentum, P1 and P2. And this, of course, is just given by the usual sort of definition. I have some outstates, I have some instates, and the S matrix just maps the instates to the outstates. Okay, so sort of in large part, or in some part, the last 10 years has sort of been sort of doing this program. Then you take this S matrix, and then for sort of for very long states, you can use the asymptotic beta ansatz to calculate the energies. And for short strings, you can use the so-called thermodynamic beta ansatz or the Y system and so on. There's been lots of progress on these sort of things. In the study of integrable models, though, often the next step is to turn to the study of form factors. So in integrable models, sort of quite generally, the next step is the study of form factors. So here I have, I'm going to use some notation. So when I have an index I and I put a line under it, this means sort of I1 through IN. As I have some form factor for some operator O, of course, it's going to be characterized by some set of momenta as well. And essentially, this is defined by I have some vacuum state, I have some local operator O, and then I have some momentum in the in state, P1 through PN, as I say, characterized by quantum numbers in addition to their momenta. And it's usually the case here that for these sort of so-called auxiliary form factors, I mean the case where the momentum are ordered. So P1 is greater than P2, is greater than Pn. With all of the other sort of configurations, I consider these things as analytic functions of the momenta, and sort of all the other configurations are calculated by analytic continuation. And all other orderings by analytic continuation. And in particular, also here, of course, I only have particles in the in-state. You can find particles in the out-state by making some sort of crossing transformation, in particular when it's a relativistic model.
When you write P1 up to Pn,
yeah,
with some order, do you mean a single plane wave, or is it a linear combination of plane waves, like in the Python? So you write a linear combination, and you choose one to a different
one. Okay, so here, this is sort of a normal sort of scattering state of plane waves. That's right. So,
it's just one plane.
Oh no, sorry. There's sort of n. Yes. No, sorry. N external particles. N external particles.
So I understand. N external particles. Is it a single plane wave due to the IP1, X1, X2, X2, and so on? Or is it a linear combination of n partial plane waves with S matrices related to
them? So for the sort of the string world sheet theory, the particles, the asymptotic particles, are free, right? So then I just mean, so the S matrix is just one, and so there's no sort of permutation thing. When I consider putting them, like say, on a spin chain, and then sort of through infinite volume, then yes, then I will mean something like a proper basis state where there is all the different permutations are there related by the S matrix.
Even in the case that where it is one, it is different to put all the all the plane waves with different permutations, or to put just a single one would be very different, right? Even if the S matrix is one.
Mm-hmm.
Wouldn't it? E to the I P1 X1 plus P2 X2 plus dot dot dot, or this plus the sum over permutations, this is a different thing.
Well, yes, but I guess the normalization will be different, but other than that, it's just going to be the same. So here, I guess I really do just mean sort of the normal.
No, it's different. E to the IP1 X1 plus IP2 X2 plus no. P1 and P2 exchange is different than the
okay. So this state here is just AP1 dagger, AP2 dagger, APN dagger acting on my Fock vacuum. It's sort of, if I'm calculating an actual scattering thing, I have sort of the asymptotic state. It's just constructed by the free sort of.
So it's a single plane.
So in this case, it's a single
plane.
Yes, but
okay.
But when, yeah, okay.
Okay, that's all I wanted to know. If it's a single plane wave or if it's n factorial plane.
Yeah. Actually, but no, it's a slight. It's a little bit tricky also because. I guess when I actually want to consider these things sort of in the string world sheet theory, then I'm going to want to consider sort of the case where they interpolate between weak and strong coupling, and then here I actually will want proper beta states where I have
so for example, if by this A, which are a bit formal, if you mean this creation operators B, right?
Yeah, so exactly.
They
so then
create the two of plane waves, they don't create one.
Right, so if I'm using something like Fadiyev's Zamolodchikov algebra, then these things don't commute with each other, and then sort of, so then these would be like this B operator in sort of the algebra.
Well,
of beta
but that's a logical operator.
No,
are...
So here, for most of the part of the talk, I'm actually just going to be talking about doing normal sort of perturbative calculations. And so then my asymptotic states will really be just sort of the normal
single plane.
Single plane. Okay.
Then if you wanted to reconstruct the other, you would just do linear combinations of your result with different orders of these.
Yes, right. And so the way it's done is that you define sort of the function with the boundary value with sort of one order, and then all of the other orderings are defined by sort of analytic continuations. Yes. And then you can reconstruct the full thing by sort of combining them all together. Okay, so that's those. Right, and in principle, for an integrable model, such things give us a complete specification of all correlation functions. So, such null factors give all correlation functions of local operators. And so if we want to sort of understand any integrable model, there are sort of a natural set of things to actually calculate. And so given that we're sort of interested in understanding the string world sheet in ADS5 times S5, it's naturally interesting to try and calculate such form factors. More specifically, of course, in the context of ADS CFT, sort of the objects of sort of proximate interest are three-point functions. So if I have some local operators, and here I mean conform sort of gauge theory operators. So I have three operators in my conformal field theory, so in n equals 4 Spinning Mills. I would like to calculate sort of the this object. In particular, of course, the dependence on the positions is sort of fixed by conformal invariants up to some constants, the structure constants, which would be sort of the basic data of the theory that I'd be interested in calculating. And in by the ADS CFT correspondence, sort of, and again being somewhat schematic, such three-point functions in n equals 4 are related to world sheet correlation functions of string vertex operators. So to calculate such three-point functions, I'd be interested in calculating such string theory three-point functions of vertex operators. Operators, and these, of course, are x3, and these are sort of the boundary coordinates of the ADS space. So we'd be, of course, naturally interesting to try and find a relationship between such string correlation functions and form factors, and it's a little bit tempting to sort of try and think of, say, V1 as creating in state, V3 as creating an out state, and then V2 being some sort of local operator between your asymptotic states. Now, unfortunately, that's a little bit complicated, plus V2 as the sort of inserted operator. Now, it's a little bit, as I say, a little bit tricky for sort of the following reason, that sort of in general, such strings, such vertex operators are creating strings that have different vacua. So the vacua that these vertex operators will create will be different, and V2 is some exponential operator which can sort of change the nature of your vacuum. And so it doesn't necessarily fit quite so naturally into such form factors, where of course, you know, the asymptotic states are built on the same vacua, and the operator sort of is a local operator. There's some sort of more complicated gluing going on. But there is one sort of place where you can sort of hope to make progress, and that would be in this so-called heavy light case. So for heavy light case, so in this case, V1 and V3 create strings with large angular momentum on the S5. So I have J1, which is the same as J3, sort of two small corrections, which is going to be much, much larger than J2. And the angular momentum of the string characterizes the length of your vacuum. It sort of characterizes your vacuum. So in this particular case, the vacua are going to be the same as each other, up two small corrections. And the sort of other string doesn't sort of change the nature of your vacuum. It won't have, it'll be, well, it can be treated as a local operator. So in this case, yes, this form factor.
Is V1 similar to V3, or they are just big, but they can be very different?
So they have to be big, but also they have to be sort of the same in some sense, right? They have to be the same. So you know, there's whatever, different angular momenta. They have to be in the same plane.
Yeah, but can one be a circular string and the other a folded string, a completely different string, or they must be roughly the same as in the usual field?
Yeah. So the case that I have in mind is where I only have some small number of insertions. So you know, sort of near BMN strings. But I don't know that anything would go wrong if I added lots of insertions. But I have to admit, yeah, the cases where I can sort of at least cleanly think about it, I'm thinking about near BMN.
What about the case that these are not the same vector, but equivalent vector?
You mean up to some sort of rotation or something like this? So, okay, I don't know the answer to really any of these questions. I think actually even this case should be possible to express this in terms of form factors. You're just going to have to do some sum and some sewing procedure, but I don't know what it is. And so I have to say, I don't know what it would be in that case either. Again, it's probably possible, but I don't know. This case should work in a very straightforward fashion. And so that's why this one, I think, is at least worthwhile considering and sort of motivates looking at these things, which is really all that I sort of want to do at the moment. I don't really have an answer. The form factor picture is more natural. And it's worthwhile, so sort of related to these questions, is comparing with sort of the weak coupling. So I think sort of the original version at weak coupling. Ivan Volovich used spin chain description to calculate structure constants. Level for sort of an SU2 sector. So there's two complex scalars, phi1 and phi2. And I have two operators of the same length, so the treat for SU2 sector with two operators of the same length. And so these operators are of the form, so I have O1 and O3, and they're sort of BMN operators, right? So they're sort of single trace operators with some phase, and they have some number of impurities, 2s plus 1 for L. L is the length of the operator. And so then I have some phi2 in some sort of large space of phi1s, so phi2 and phi1 L minus 2 minus s. So these are sort of these so-called BMN operators, right? So I have a single trace, I have large numbers of phi1s, and I have sort of some number of impurities. Here I just have two impurities. So sort of the operators phi1 and phi3 are some large operators, and they have the same length with some small number of impurities. And then the sort of other operator is some operator that doesn't change the number, or doesn't change the length. So it's phi1, phi1 bar, minus phi2, sorry. I put them in a different place. Two bar two. Okay. And so, sort of for these sort of operators, they related the calculation of the gauge theory structure constants to some spin chain form factor. So structure constants are proportional to some beta state with some number, some rapidities. Basically, these are some numbers that characterize exactly which operator you have. Then there was some local operator, just the spin operator in the Z, so it's the Cartan generator for And it, you can, the actual spin chain location doesn't matter. You can factorize out the exact position. And then there's the other state, also characterized by some set of rapidities. These are data states. OK. So as I say, so in this case here, you can relate the calculation of the structure constants to actually spin chain form factors. And we'll see that you can sort of, for a certain case, you can actually interpolate between the world sheet form factors and the spin chain form factors, of such a type. And so it seems reasonably plausible that for at least this class, if not more, that the actual calculation of the world sheet form factors will be related to the calculation of structure constants. And then the final reason for actually doing this is that you can actually calculate such things. You can actually find exact answers for the form factors. Is this part? Well, yeah, okay. So, and then, so as I say, the sort of final reason is that for integrable models, it's challenging, to put it mildly, but doable to calculate such form factors exactly. And so we might actually hope that we can do such a thing for the world sheet theory too. There's standard methods, or at least somewhat reliable methods, for actually doing these calculations. And so even if we were only able to find exact answers for this sort of heavy light case, that would be sort of a, you know, the problem of calculating the structure constants, say, to all orders is an extremely difficult problem. Even, you know, only for BPS operators can you, are there really any good answers. And so being able to make progress in any case would be sort of a useful thing. And the way that this works is that you can use sort of very general properties. Of analyticity, unitarity, and bound states. To find general functional equations. Formulate functional equations that can then be solved. And so most of this was done sort of in the relativistic case. And so what I want to sort of do in this talk is to sort of write down a version of these functional equations for the relativistic case for the string world sheet. And then just sort of try to, well, I'll just describe some checks that we did. And then, of course, the thing that we really like to do would actually be to solve those things. And that I can't give you an answer for, but maybe I can sort of suggest some possibilities.
Is it fair to say that, suppose you go to four-point function or IM, you have to also integrate the location of the vertex operator on the worksheet? This is not a problem, because as long as we solve for this form factor in terms of states that diagonalize energy momentum, then it's trivial to integrate. It's an eigenstate of the operator.
Sounds right, but I have to admit I haven't thought about exactly that question. Okay. The simplest case is some sort of simple example. If I have a two-particle form factor in a Lorentz invariant theory, so here I have f I1, I2 for some operator, and I'm in the sort of, I want to consider a physical form factor, so it'll depend on the normal Lorentz invariant, so P1 plus P2 squared. And as I say, sort of these objects, just like the S matrix, they'll have branch cuts and so on, sort of with different regions being separated. So I give an I epsilon prescription So I'm above sort of the branch cut in the S-plane. This is the physical region for such an object. And by that, I mean that this object is defined as zero, whatever operator I'm considering, P1, P2, where I take the positive energy in state, I1, I2. OK, so this is sort of the definition of form factor. And I can insert a complete set of states, and I'll insert a complete set of outstates into this thing. So I have the sum over all outstates, 0, my operator, out, out, P1, P2, in, I1, I2. Now, for an integrable model, sort of the two-particle in-state will only go to a two-particle out-state. There's no particle creation. So I only need to consider two-particle out-states here. And so here I'll find sort of a two-particle form factor, but it'll be sort of in the non-physical region. So this sort of the two-particle form factor, this gives me J1, J2 of S12 minus I epsilon. So I'm sort of in the non-physical region below the branch cut. And then here I just have the two-particle S matrix, J1, J2, I1, I2, P1, P2. So sort of the discontinuity in the form factor as I go across the branch cut in the S-plane is just given by the whorl sheet S matrix. So this is, of course, extremely standard. So this is, strictly speaking, only for integral model. And is called Watson's equation, or this and the generalization to sort of more and more particles are Watson's equations. But you can write down sort of as I say, a sort of generalization of this equation and to describe all of these things. And so that's what. And sort of these properties can be, strictly speaking, formalized in terms of some set of axioms. So such properties can be formalized.
Can I explain again? I missed this point. Okay. The signs of I epsilon is in this equation.
Okay, so these are sort of analytic functions of their arguments, just for example, the S matrix. They have branch cuts in the S channel. So there's some.
You can draw a simple picture.
S plane, right? And there will be a branch cut in the. And so this region here is the physical region. And by that, I mean it's the form factor when I have positive energy in states. So this is the physical region. And below is the sort of non-physical region where I basically put sort of. I sort of analytically continue this to an outstate. Right, so this is the non-physical region. So that's the form factor defined sort of below the branch cut. And so this, so here I've just inserted a complete set of bases. This is for integral model, the only outstate that contributes is the two-particle one. So this just gives me the two-particle. So this sum collapses. So I just get the two-particle S matrix. So in terms of FZ algebra, this is sort of like Smirnov. I'm not going to be so rigorous. I don't want to, or not. I'm not going to be so sort of formal. Rather, what I'll do is I'll just sort of define a set of properties for these little f's. So the objects that we're interested in. So first of all, I introduce rapidity. I for all of my particles, so I have n particles, and as I say, these auxiliary form factors, which depend on all of the rapidities, are defined as the form factors. So here I would mean the generalization of this. So it's sort of these objects where I have some instate, where I have n momenta and n indices. But for Lorentz invariant theory, of course, it only depends on differences. So the auxiliary form factors, which are functions of the individual rapidities, are sort of defined, well, their boundary value is defined as the physical form factors for a specific ordering of the rapidities, and then they're defined for all other sort of orderings by analytic continuation. So this is sort of your boundary value. Okay, so the sort of properties are permutation.
Why did you put absolute value?
Sorry, what?
Why did you put absolute value? That was signing defined by analytical domain.
Right, no, they really can be written as only functions of, like, say, 2, or, sorry, 1, 2. So 1 minus 2 will always be positive.
So I bigger than J.
I bigger than J, that's right. Okay, so the properties are, permutation. Oh, and so if I exchange two rapidities, it's related to the original ordering. By the S matrix, right? So J. Okay. Periodicity, which says sort of I perform a double crossing transformation on the rapidities. So I have to n, 1, to 2, blah. N, this is equal to theta 1, theta 3, n, o, theta 2, theta n, theta 1 minus 2 pi, pi. Okay. I wanted to put it all on blackboard. I'm going to erase this part, it doesn't really matter so much. So, one particle poles. So, in addition to, of course, sort of this analytic behavior, they also will have various poles. In particular, if I have two particles, if the sum of them sort of becomes zero, and an intermediate sort of channel will go on shell. And a way to say that in terms of rapidities just is that if I take the rapidity difference of any two particles, here just choosing 1 and 2, if this becomes I pi, then there will be a pole in the form factor. And 1, 2, n, and the residue of that pole is given by some constants. So this is the charge conjugation matrix, just relates to sort of the particles, and it's related to the sort of form factor with some smaller number of legs, some smaller number of external particles, theta 3, 2, theta n, and then times the identity matrix minus the product of S matrices of the second particle with the nth particle, with the n minus 1 particle, all the way down to the third particle. So that's the pole structure for one particle. And then finally, if there's sort of additional bound states in the problem, so for example, if you think of sine Gordon, of course, you know, an additional, you know, sort of there's all sorts of bound states, or when individual particles, special values of the momenta. So let me say it this way. If at some combination, if two particles form a bound state, so if at theta 1, 2, theta 1, 2, at some special value of the rapidity difference, and state, such that, so if there's a bound state, there will be a pole in the S matrix. So if the residue of the S matrix is given by some, so here again, I'm also being a little bit schematic because I'm dropping the index structure because you have to put in projectors and so on. I don't want to do that. So you can think of this as just sort of say in some rank one sector, but you can include the indices if you want. But the key point anyways is that if there's a bound state such that the residue of the S matrix gives me some factor, then the form factor will also have, then the form factor will also have a pole in the same place, one, two, and this will be related to the form factor where the external particle is the bound state, the remaining particles, and the remaining factor is the square root of the coefficient or the residue of the S matrix. So I've completely messed up this blackboard, but anyway, that's the sort of four properties. And sort of these two are very similar to sort of just the normal, say, unitarity arguments, right? If you're familiar with calculating, say, amplitudes through unitarity, these essentially give you sort of the generalized unitarity arguments. They give you the discontinuities of the form factor. Whereas these ones, this one here, relates form factors with sort of some number of legs to form factors with some smaller number of legs. And then finally, this will determine sort of any sort of additional singularities. So in principle, you can use these two to determine the particle form factors that have discontinuities, so they have logarithms or whatnot, and then you can determine the remaining rational parts or the parts without singularities by a knowledge of the bound state poles and sort of a recursive relation between form factors with different numbers of legs.
What's the argument for number three, similar to this one?
Okay, so for our purposes, these are just going to be axioms. They're just put in by hand. For, say, Sine-Gordon theory, where you have a normal relativistic model, you can actually derive these things using sort of the LSZ formulation, right? I mean, this one here is, you can think of it just even, say, from Feynman diagrams, right? You'll have singularities in all factorization channels, right? And this just gives you this. And the actual coefficient you can calculate, as I say, by just going through the actual definition of form factor.
So there's no simple picture to motivate it. I mean, like here,
this is just sort of factorization in subchannels. That's what it is. To get the actual expression, then I guess, yeah. I don't know if a simple argument for giving both of these terms, but you can see it with not too much difficulty by sort of looking at the actual definition of the form and the LSC formalism. The point then would be, this of course is for relativistic invariant theories, these are the ones for Sine-Gordon, Cinch-Gordon, all that kind of thing. For the string whirl sheet theory, it's a little bit different. Although in the end, we'll see that with just a little bit of effort, we can propose essentially exactly the same axioms. But just let me briefly describe some of the differences for the string whirl sheet theory. So by this, of course, I mean light cone, gauge fixed. And in this case, the string length divided by 2 pi is given by 1 minus a times j plus a times curly e, where curly j is the angular momentum density. So the square root lambda is the effect of string tension or the Tuft coupling. So this is my angular momentum density, the string energy. The curly e is the energy density. A is sort of a gauge parameter. There's sort of various different gauge fixings that you can do. There's various different light cone gauges by taking different combinations of light cone coordinates. And so this A is a parameter that corresponds to different choices, which would be useful if I get to it, but we'll see. Okay, so there's, in this theory, so of course you have 8 bosonic and 8 fermionic degrees of freedom. The vacuum has some PSU 2/2 squared centrally extended symmetries. So as the symmetries of the vacuum. And so for the string whirl sheet theory, these indices I, j, and so on correspond to PSU 2/2 squared indices. Importantly, of course, the dispersion relation E squared is 1 plus 4 g squared sine squared p over 2, where here g is the square root lambda over 4 pi. So this is the sort of dispersion relation for the string whirl sheet theory, and it's quite obviously not Lorentz invariant, as sort of is well known. And so sort of that's why, of course, these axioms are going to be needed to be sort of modified slightly. In particular, we need to have sort of the analog of the rapidity parameter. So to do that, sort of it's uniformize the dispersion relation is uniformized by Jacobi elliptic functions rather than hyperbolic functions. Functions. So if the momentum is given by the Jacobi amplitude of the parameter z, and then the energy is dn k, where the modulus k is equal to minus 4 g squared, which of course is less than 0. And so in this case, the sort of analog of the rapidity rapidity plane is a torus. So we have a defined on a torus with periods 2/1, which is given by 4 times k times the modulus. This is the elliptic integral of the first kind. And then the imaginary period 2/2 is some other expression, k 1 minus k minus. So in this case, rather than having our form factors being functions of theta, they're going to be functions, analytic functions of of z's for sort of one for each parameter. And it's worthwhile sort of mentioning just sort of two sort of useful limits. One is when if we take g goes to infinity while rescaling our momenta, rescaling momenta g goes to p over g, then in this case the model becomes relativistic invariant. The model is relativistic invariant, so that p just becomes the usual expression, sinh of z. And in the other case, if we take g to go to 0, in this case, in this case here, the torus becomes sort of a long strip, just sort of like the normal physical rapidity plane for a relativistic model. And in the opposite limit where g goes to 0, in that case, the imaginary period becomes infinite. So omega 2 goes to 2i log g. And so in this case, the torus also becomes an infinite strip. But importantly, in this case, sort of the crossing becomes infinite. So the sort of the crossing transformation sort of becomes an infinite transformation. For this theory, sort of the S matrix, the exact S matrix is known, and it has some rich spectrum of bound states. And so given that we sort of know so much, we can try and write down sort of the same axioms for the string Roshi theory. And as I say, essentially it just corresponds to replacing the parameters in the appropriate way. So these will just become functions of the rigidity parameters Zi and Zj. For periodicity, of course, the periodic sort of the crossing relation now is not given by 2 pi I, but is given by the imaginary by the imaginary period 2 omega 2. There will also be one particle poles. These occur for values z1 and z2 such that p12, which is given by p1 of z plus z1 plus p2 of z2 is given by 0. And then in that case, you have that, so when p12 is 0, there will be a pole in the form factors, 1, 2, n. And it's the same. I mean, again, you'll have some charge conjugation matrix, you'll have some form factor with some reduced number of legs, and you have the same sort of factorization, but of course now you have an S matrix which depends on the different, on the various rapidities. And similarly for the bound state one, there will be bound states when some linear combination, so z12, which is z1 minus z2 is equal to
is it just the difference?
Yeah, that's what I have.
It should be the difference of rapidities u, right?
Yeah, that's right.
But not difference of z.
Yeah, okay, so that's right. Not exactly. It's not. So, if at I haven't actually said what I meant by u. Okay, but so if at some values of z1 and z2 there is a bound state, then the residue, where the residue of the S matrix is given by some factor, then there will be the residue of the form factor. Will have the same bound state. This actually is terrible notation. So this one actually, this last one is the one that sort of is least sort of checked, in particular for the following reasons. I have 10 minutes left, so I'll try and say what we did to sort of try and check these things. So for one thing, as I say, obviously these are extremely sort of just naively generalized, but the question of course remains is that are they actually true? For relativistic models, you can actually derive them using this LSZ formalism, but it's not at all clear. You know, you can't do the same thing for the string Roshi theory, or at least I don't know what the general method would be. So the only thing that we can do is just to try and check them perturbatively. So there's two cases. So we can check at weak and strong coupling. For the coupling being very, very large, then use a perturbative Lightcon action. So in this case, the string model is just some some massive, the free part is just some massive relativistic theory, and then there's some quartic interaction, so it's some derivative with respect to the spatial coordinate, y bar prime, and then in principle, it does depend on the gauge choice, which actually I wanted to mention, but we'll see. Y squared minus y squared y squared. And there will be all other sort of fields and also higher derivative corrections, but it's just a straightforward matter to actually calculate such form factors using sort of the normal prescription, right? So they just correspond to sort of connected, amputated Feynman diagrams. Now, using this action, sort of, so this is, you can sort of do the tree level calculation. And at tree level, sort of all of the axioms are essentially trivial. In particular, sort of, you know, there's no logarithms, there's no discontinuities. You can check the one particle poles work, but you also don't see the bound states. To actually get something non-trivial, to get non-trivial results, we used the so-called Swanson or near flat limit. And in this case, you sort of you focus on a subclass of the excitations. So basically, you make a boost on your world sheet so that all of you only so the right movers decouple. And in this case, we were able to perform one loop and two loop calculations for the operators being sort of just a single fundamental field, or in other case, the sort of fundamental field squared. And so and. For various numbers of particles, so we had so we checked sort of Fy for three external particles and Fy squared for two and four. Actually, this one for two loops and this one for one loop. It doesn't really matter too much. But basically, the point I just want to make is that basically, we, you know, perform some small number of perturbative checks, and in this case, you can actually see that indeed, sort of the discontinuities all come out right. Essentially, as I say, they just come from sort of the normal discontinuities that you find in Feynman diagrams, using sort of the S matrix that you know, and you also see that all the one particle poles also come out. The thing you can't see is you can't see the bound states. Doing perturbation theory about the trivial vacuum, you don't see these non-perturbative bound states. And so to actually see those, you have to go to weak coupling. I didn't write it down, and I won't because I don't have enough time. But one thing is that you can calculate just the tree level version of this in the BMN limit. And this is the one that you can then actually perform a double scaling limit and match with weak coupling. But I won't have time for that either.
All the cases you're considering.
Sorry?
In all the cases you would consider pinching is infinite, and you just consider a single thing oil.
Right. In all of these cases, we're looking at sort of the decompactification limit of the world sheets. That's right. But the S matrix is not trivial, right? The S matrix is. But in order to see the last axiom, or to try and sort of see how these axioms would work in the opposite region, we have to go to weak coupling. And of course, as I say, the axioms should hold exactly, so it's not just an issue of that part. So,
do you expect a version of it to hold also in the compact case?
I don't really know what it would mean then for a form factor in the compact case, right? But because I don't know what it means, like asymptotic states and so on. But
eigenstate of the
Hamiltonian.
Eigenstate of the dilatation.
Yes.
If you really want to use this to solve.
I understand. Yeah. Absolutely. There's many problems. So first of all, you might expect that you can, strictly speaking, only use these things sort of for the asymptotic case. And then, if you want to go to finite case, you're going to have to build in some sort of finite corrections. And then I don't know, that's going to be another question, yes. But, okay, so you can see some of these things already just by looking at the spin chain. And so there, you can think about the finite, the compact case, and you can see sort of how some of these things work. So just let me briefly just say, okay. So again, I'm going to be going too quickly, but sort of at weak coupling, we can use the spin chain description, right? So then we have sort of the Heisenberg dilatation generator is the Heisenberg spin chain. Heisenberg spin chain Hamiltonian. Okay. And then as I mentioned, sort of, you know, you can use this model to calculate certain structure constants for some simple cases. The vacuum in this case, of course, is the ferromagnetic vacuum. This corresponds to the Carl primary operator. Excited states, x1, x2, correspond to acting with lowering operators on the various various spin lowering operators. x1 is minus x2, acting on the vacuum. And the energy eigenstates, these are made by taking linear combinations of these excited states. There's some normalization, there's some sum, x1, l, ip1, p2, x1, xn, x1, xn, where these phases are this thing that we were sort of briefly discussing earlier. So for example, chi p1, p2 is given by e to the minus I, theta 1, 2, e to the I, p1, x1, plus p2, x2, plus e to the I, theta 1, 2, over 2, e to the I, p1, x2, plus p2, x1, where this phase here, so the S matrix, is given by e to the I, theta 1, 2. And so I'll just say in words, so this is sort of the so-called beta states, and then you can form spin chain operators, a spin chain form factors, P1 prime operator, P1, Pn. So this would be some spin chain form factor. And you can ask, does this spin chain form factor satisfy the same axioms? And so the first one, permutation, sort of just follows it. Most they just follow immediately from sort of the definition of the spin chain of the energy eigenstates. So for example, sort of if you ask how this thing acts under permutation, so if I exchange P1 and P2, you do indeed just pick up a factor of the S matrix. And so this, if I sort of permute two of the momenta here, this form factor will pick up a factor of the S matrix. It doesn't have periodicity. As I said earlier, in the weak coupling limit, this sort of the crossing transformation becomes infinite. And so there is no, the periodicity transformation sort of is an infinite transformation and can't be seen here in the spin chain. The same is also true of the one particle poles. You can't take trying to go to the cross channel where you take two particles to be zero, you don't see those poles. What you can do is you can put particles in the out state and then you will see the corresponding poles. The last one, which is sort of the one that was most important, is can you see the residues of the bound states? And indeed, for the Heisenberg spin chain, you can find bound states and you will find that there will be, if there's a divergence in the S matrix, you'll find a divergence in the wave function. You have to take into account, then to find the wave function for the bound state, you have to sort of renormalize the original eigenstate, and you can find the corresponding divergence in the form factor, and the residue is related to the residue of the S matrix. So in this case, you can see sort of the...
let me just ask again. With strong coupling, do you consider the analog state or do you consider just a single plane wave? Because naively, I would consider that. Are you at strong coupling also considering the similar kind of states and therefore permutation is also built in at strong coupling, or no, at strong coupling, permutation is less true and it's something
else? So the form factors I consider as some analytic functions of these rapidity variables. Yeah. If I want to calculate them sort of in perturbation theory, then I actually have to give you an explicit definition for what I mean by sort of the this.
Actually, coupling it was very well defined, but that's from coupling. What did you do for this P2P?
Okay, so to calculate these form factors, I calculate amputated connected Feynman diagrams using sort of standard perturbative methods. Right? So my asymptotic states are defined using free creation and annihilation operators. I use the LSE formulation to, it's the standard field theory definition. What that does, though, is that calculates the boundary value for the form factor, and then for a particular ordering, and then the actual form factor, these auxiliary form factors, these objects here, for which I have the axioms, are then defined by analytic continuation.
They just don't seem related then.
In one case,
you use the state, in the other case, you use single plane lines.
Well,
so are they the same object that you are studying?
There is some object, which is some non-trivial function of the coupling and is an analytic function of its arguments, and they do interpolate between each other. So I'm already over time, because maybe it is relevant to this question, is that I can literally take the form factor calculated in this at strong coupling in the near plane wave case. Particularly, I can take this one. I can calculate the same thing at strong coupling, at weak coupling in the spin chain, right? And you can literally you take the thermodynamic limit, the normal case where you can do this double scaling limit, and you can find that you find the exact same answer from the near plane wave case as you find in the thermodynamic limit of the spin chain. So it really is this, now, of course, as you know, this is slightly fortuitous and so on, but it is literally the same object that's being calculated in both cases. It's just you have different definitions for your asymptotic states and for your spin chain states, but the actual objects themselves, the form factor you have, is the same. It's exactly the same as for the S matrix. How do I calculate the S matrix in the world sheet theory? How do I calculate the S matrix in the spin chain? It's a slightly different prescription. For an S matrix, you have free asymptotic states and so on. But here, it's slightly different. Let me finish. I didn't explain how you can actually find explicit expressions that interpolate between the two, at least in one specific case. But that is true. But it's also slightly a bit of a cheat. Really, what you'd like to do is to calculate these things exactly. And so this is sort of outlawed. Finish. So the one point that I want to make is that you can actually use, so here we have some checks that these axioms are right. So if we do then just take them to be correct, we can actually hopefully use them to actually determine such form factors exactly. And so, for example, two particle form factor. Now here I'm just going to be, say, in Sine-Gordon theory. The two particle form factor has the following form. So it has some normalization, which depends on the operator. It has some periodic function of its argument, which basically is determined by the poles. And then it has the so-called minimal solution of the functional equation. And I can take the axioms to show that this minimal function satisfies the following functional equation. Okay. So this is basically just the specific case of these axioms for two particles. And you can write down the solution to this thing essentially immediately, again, quite formally, as just an infinite product of the S matrices. So this is the sort of defining relation, and this relation will, of course, be sort of formally will be a solution to this equation. To actually extract explicit expressions, you need to sort of use a version of the S matrix.
What says this minimal solution is unique?
I don't have, guys. So it is a solution. So for Sine-Gordon, you can write the S matrix in the following form. T sinh theta I pi T dt. So this is true for, say, breather scattering or soliton breather scattering, for all of the different ones. But given the S matrix written in this form, you can then sort of also write down an integral expression for this minimal solution. I'll go go up. Because I, so then in this case, it should be given by. So if I know the exact S matrix, I can find a minimal solution for the form factor, and then I can find the exact two. So this, as I said, if I know the exact S matrix in this form, I can find the exact form factor in this form, and then I can reconstruct the other parts. Well, you need to find the normalization that can be done from some field theory argument. This part comes from a knowledge of the bound states, and can also sort of be determined. The normalization, of course, depends on the operator. So, and this gives you sort of exact answers. Now, and then you can also sort of, this minimal solution occurs in all sort of, if I add more and more external legs and so on, I get more complicated answers. You can build similar answers from similar sort of building blocks.
What did you say about K, sorry? I missed what you said about K.
K is a periodic function that basically
depends
puts
on the operator as well, right?
No, it well, at least, so for the two-particle case for sine Gordon, it just depends on a knowledge of what the bound states of sine Gordon is.
All form factors in sine Gordon are the same up to a constant?
Two-particle.
So all two-particle form factors in sine Gordon, no matter what operator I compute, I always get this with.
No, well, oh, sorry, okay. This minimal solution depends on what S matrix you use. So if I have breather.
For sine Gordon.
But for the actual operator, yeah, I think in that case, the normalization
is the only place where the operator ends. It's a number. If I make ratio of two form factors, it's just ratio of two.
Okay. Yeah, that's I'm not 100% certain that's the right answer, but yes, that's, I guess, what I'm saying. I know it's, that seems too strong. But okay, but it's possible. Okay, so let's say in principle there could be some. But the thing is, the operator shouldn't depend on the external momentum. Okay. Anyway,
I would suspect this case should depend on all of
it. Yeah. So that's, I guess that seems reasonable. Okay. Although, as I say, it only depends on the bound states, the actual external particle. Like you constructed by saying what the bound states, what poles arise from bound states of the external part.
Maybe you can constrain the poles it has and so on, but then maybe you cannot constrain completely the function k block. Otherwise, it would be too strong, right?
So this would then
correlation function make ratios, and they will be the same.
Then this would come to do with the question of what the uniqueness of this solution is, and so I guess it's possible that that's true. I have no claim of what the uniqueness of this solution is. There are more fundamental methods for doing such things. Okay, but the point that I wanted to make is that can you sort of then generalize this solution, this minimal solution, to the string whorl sheet theory, and at least in the near flat limit, and then also sort of order by order, it seems that indeed you can sort of write down the S matrix. So to two loops, I can write down the S matrix, this sort of expression, and so you can generate a minimal solution that then seems to agree with the perturbative calculation. So the question would be then, can you actually find sort of an all-order version of this S matrix, sort of in some version that you can analytically continue, so that you can find some form factors for the string whorl sheet theory to all orders. That would be obviously one question that would be nice. And then the second thing would be, can you actually make connections, say, with the calculation of the form factors, with correlation functions, with three-point functions, say, in some sort of semi-classical limit. OK, thanks very much.
For three-point functions, there are so many operators you can consider, it's hard to imagine that all correlation functions would be the same up to a number. It depends on the momentum. Right? You can consider a correlation function where the operator could depend just to sigma z, like the example you did, or to a huge amount.
No, that's right. So the dependence, so here, what the dependence on the other quantum numbers are. In principle, you could imagine. Yeah. sounds reasonable.
For the question of what you put, the pure plane wave or the eigenstate, I think if you assume that xc1 is valid, then they are the same. But
so assume what?
If you assume xc1,
then
if
they're
you assume
the same.
Once you commute two particles, you get the S metric. Then by construction, they put in just a plane wave or all the same factorial combination with S metrics, then you give the same.
No, because that property depends on what you put as external state. That property can be true, can be false if you put, say, just a plane wave, for example.
If you assume it is correct and you put just a plane wave, then the other one follows.
But for example, at weak coupling, we know that's not true. At weak coupling, if you would put just P1, P2, just single, as Trisam was explaining, at weak coupling, it's crucial to put a two plane wave, right?
No, yeah. A weak coupling. The basis state, of course, is defined this way. These are the NG eigenstates. So I use those to calculate the form factors.
And if you would use just a single plane wave, of course, when you exchange p's, nothing would happen, and you would not get that axiom.
That's right.
So axiom 1 is by construction, not really.
So axiom 1.
So here, axiom 1 is sort of by construction. It's by the fact that I use basis states as my external states, right? I mean, that's.
But that strong coupling, that analog statement, is that matrix is 1? No.
No. That's the thing. At strong coupling,
it's different. But in
so at strong coupling, the actual definition of the external state.
Well, let me ask different. Is it true that you have no doubt that that axiom was true because of the way the computation is set up, and since you know how to compute S matrix?
No.
That axiom was obvious that it would work both at weak and strong coupling. Is it a true statement?
So at strong coupling, the first axiom and I suppose the second one are essentially, as I say, sort of unitarity. It tells you sort of just like, you know, the discontinuities in your object are related by sort of.
Those are the ones you need to hop to work, number 1 and 2, right? Both at weak and strong coupling. It's just a statement that we didn't do anything wrong. They are more or less trivial.
Yeah. I guess I don't know. I mean, the world sheet theory is not Lorentz invariant. I guess yes, you're right. I wasn't too worried that it wasn't going to that it wouldn't that you couldn't do cutting rules, right? I mean, although it felt necessary to check it. I mean, it seemed likely, but it didn't seem completely trivial. But right, as long as the theory is sort of local and unitary, then this one will also work. But this issue about how you define this, I mean, if I could sort of define at strong coupling, I could define the theory in terms of some Fadiev's and Malogikov algebra, and then my states wouldn't be sort of these free states. They would be defined in terms of sort of the exact creation operators, and now they don't commute, and now it's very important to pick a specific ordering to define what the actual form factor is.
It's not obvious to me why the two computations are the same, but they must be. The way this amputation works, it must in practice maybe be the equivalent, but it's just not obvious why.
It's just, one is that you build in the interactions into the definition of the state, and then the other one you sort of build in the interactions into sort of the definition or into the sort of propagation from.
Exactly.
Yeah. It,
probably using just, here you probably always use in states, and in one case you use in and out states, and the S matrix appears when you convert from.
But
Is it fair to say that it's not important for the operator to be local because all the axioms are linear in small f?
Yeah, this is another very good question. So so from the axioms you can prove things like sort of locality and sort of that you can from the axioms you can prove locality of the theory.
I think the last periodicity, right? The one that requires to be local because you have to go around the operator. So if it would be something unlocal, the periodicity one is not local.
No, but they're defined for sort of the.
If you take linear combinations, local operators, it's in general not local.
But if I take, you have to take an infinite number, an infinite linear combination, right? And then there's an issue about convergence of this, sort of this infinite sum. This would be the sort of thing. Say I want some exponential operator, right? Then you have to prove that that infinite sum is sort of convergent. That would be the problem in this case. But that would be for exponential operators. For genuinely non-local operators, then it seems much more complicated. But the vertex operator should only be sort of complicated in the sense of exponential operators. I don't think they have any sort of genuine sort of world sheet non-locality built into them. Well, maybe in Lycombe gauge, actually.
What I meant is that the non-local operator that you can expand is a linear less infinite sum of local operators.
Yes. But OK, so then the issue would be about convergence of that.
Thanks, Tristan again.